Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, a great talk by historian Morris Berman. It's on the emptiness at the heart of the American dream and the emptiness at the heart of our leaders. Plus, a song by Roy Zimmerman that's a bit more upbeat. I hope you'll stay tuned. We had a good Halloween this year. Lots of kids came to the door, and we gave away lots of individually wrapped, factory-sealed for your protection little candy bars. Established power in this country loves keeping the average citizens in a state of constant fear and worry. As though we didn't have enough real fears and worries, they have kindly invented several new ones for us. Remember the missile gap? Well, maybe that was before your time. I remember it. How about teenaged black male super predators out on a rampage of random raping and murdering? Or fanatical Muslim sleeper cells throughout the U.S., ready to slit our throats when Baghdad gives the order? Remember that one? That was pretty recent. Maybe now the sleeper cells are taking orders from Tehran, not Baghdad. And of course, let's not forget, hordes of evildoers slipping razor blades into Halloween apples and injecting poison into Halloween candies. The fact that none of the above is true doesn't matter. Keep the public scared, and we'll keep begging the police state to protect us with the force and violence which is their specialty. Still, Halloween survives. Halloween celebrates old, old folk traditions. It's a festive time that actually originated with the people themselves. Halloween wasn't created by the state like Thanksgiving, and it wasn't created by the corporations like Mother's Day, or like our new de facto holiday, Black Friday, coming soon to a shopping mall near you. This year, Black Friday will begin earlier in many stores, at 8 p.m. on Thanksgiving, which means you'd better skip Thanksgiving dinner with the family and start standing in line outside the store at 3 or 4 p.m. if you want big, big savings on widescreen TVs, smartphones, and other merchandise that, presumably, will make you a happier person. Which brings us to a great talk by historian Morris Berman. It's about the hollowness at the heart of the American dream, and about the hollowness at the center of our so-called leaders. So, in our last presidential election, we could choose Romney, who is a scarecrow dressed in an expensive suit. Or we could choose Obama, who is a Disney World animatron dressed in an expensive suit. It sounds rather gloomy and depressing. It sounds like T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Men. In fact, Berman uses that phrase. But Morris Berman is fun to listen to, because he can talk about our sad predicament with such comic wit and with some humor. In this, he reminds me of economist Richard Wolff and maybe political scientist Michael Parenti. Just because the world is going to hell in a handbasket doesn't mean you can't poke fun at the handbasket. And the American Handbasket Marketing Association. And the dismal leadership of the Amalgamated Brotherhood of Handbasket Weavers, AFL-CIO. So I like listening to Morris Berman, even when he's analyzing the hollowness at the heart of the American dream, and the hollowness in the soul of America's so-called leaders. I'm going to skip the very beginning of Berman's talk, which is a little abstruse. He's making a distinction between analyzing something vertically or horizontally. Take President Obama. In a vertical analysis, you'd study the phony image he presents and try to move from that up to the truth, while pretending, like Bill Clinton, to feel your pain. Obama actually is the loyal servant of big finance and the military-industrial complex. That's a vertical analysis. In a horizontal analysis, you'd study just the image and connect it to other important images all around, and then explain what these images all are saying on their own terms. In a vertical analysis, you try to find the truth behind the illusion. In a horizontal analysis, you study all the illusions and explore what passes for truth. Okay, it's a nice distinction. But for now, we'll just state it, and we'll skip over Berman's quotes from the philosophers, from Wittgenstein and Merleau-Ponty, and of course Plato. Do you like the way I just tossed in that phrase, "of course," before I said Plato? Sorry, I was just teasing a bit. Morris Berman does that to me. Brings out the intellectual playfulness. But enough of me. Let's have some Morris Berman. Here he is, on the emptiness of the American dream and the emptiness at the heart of the American leadership class. He starts out with a vertical and then a horizontal analysis of President Obama.
To take the example of politics once again, in terms of vertical analysis, it seems clear enough by now who the real Mr. Obama is. He's the man who appointed as his economic advisors individuals who were espousing the very neoliberal ideology that led to the crash of 2008. And the man who ignored the plight of the poor and the unemployed after that crash, and instead funneled upwards of $19 trillion into the hands of Wall Street bankers, who subsequently gave themselves huge bonuses that he publicly approved of. He's the man who decried the senseless slaughter of children in Newtown, Connecticut last December, while sending predator drones to Afghanistan and Pakistan, which just happened to murder children on a regular basis. According to the New York Times, the president holds Terror Tuesdays meetings with his national security advisors every week, during which time they discuss which suspected terrorists should be assassinated by drones. In one-third of these cases, says the Times, Mr. Obama selects the targets himself, targets that have included American citizens. He talks of the great freedom enjoyed by citizens of our democracy and at the same time aggressively persecutes whistleblowers and has his intelligence agencies collecting information on virtually every man, woman, and child in the United States, as very recent revelations have shown. An analysis of this year's State of the Union address by Seamus Cook, this was in Counterpunch, at the website Counterpunch, 19th of February, showed how that speech was coded so that the corporate elite would understand that they would be increasingly in control of American society. To conclude that the president is basically a corporate and military shill, despite the veneer of faint liberal rhetoric that he occasionally comes out with, is hardly rocket science at this point. This is what a vertical analysis tells us. However, if we look at Obama horizontally, as a real shadow, so to speak, I think we discover a much subtler reality. Who is Barack Obama, in fact? If you look into his eyes through the medium of television or newspaper photographs, you see a certain type of vacancy there. Rhetoric, after all, is just rhetoric. Behind it lies an empty person. He's chic, he's poised, and in a spiritual sense, he stands for nothing at all. New York Times columnist Ross Douthat captured this quite accurately when he wrote, just last month, that Obama is basically a performance. The man is a shell. He lacks an inner moral compass, which is why Wall Street and the Pentagon and the NSA were able to seduce him so easily. Since he's an empty vessel, he was quickly filled up with the agendas of the wealthy and the powerful, such that even genocide is now part of his own agenda. Of course, the type of vacancy I'm talking about can be seen in the eyes of Mr. Clinton, Bush Jr. or Sr., or Mitt Romney. Remember that guy? He was little more than a walking haircut. I mean, he was one of the most silliest people to ever walk on to the American political stage, you know. What does it mean, however, that the American people want hollow men, as T.S. Eliot once put it, to represent them? Romney, after all, gained 47% of the popular vote. As the comedian George Carlin once put it, Where do you think our leaders come from? Mars? This finally takes us into media ecology, the larger picture, because horizontal analysis goes way beyond merely identifying these individuals as the mouthpieces of the rich and powerful. They are, but they are also the mouthpieces of nearly everyone else in the United States, which is why they get elected to office, and why the choice always boils down to Tweedledum versus Tweedledee. What American, for example, doesn't buy into the American dream? Why do soup kitchens and tent cities across the United States fly the American flag above them in a strange parody of patriotism? As John Steinbeck put it many years ago, in the United States, the poor regard themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. And as I argue in Why America Failed, the goal of the settlers on the North American continent, as far back as the late 16th century, has been capital accumulation, the pursuit of happiness, as Thomas Jefferson subsequently called it. In March of last year, the Pew Charitable Trust released the results of a poll that revealed that most Americans have no objection to the existence of a small, wealthy elite, the famous 1%. Not at all. Their goal is to become part of that elite. And they're deluded enough to think that they can do it. This is one reason why the Occupy Wall Street movement had such a short lease on life, and why social equality was a non-issue in the last presidential election, not even mentioned in the pre-election debates. Rich or poor, nearly every American wants to be rich, and in fact sees this as the purpose of life. In this sense, we have the purest democracy in the history of the world, because ideologically speaking, the American government and the American people are on the same page. To quote Calvin Coolidge, the business of America is business. Hustling is what America has always been about. This is why our elected leaders have a vacant quality about them. After all, the American dream is about a world without limits, about always having more. But more is not a spiritual path, nor is it a philosophy of life. It has no content at all. And this is why when you look into the eyes of an Obama or a Clinton or a Hillary Clinton, probably our next president, you see not merely nothing, but a kind of terrifying nothingness. Unfortunately, this vacant look characterizes a lot of the American population as well. The microcosm reflects the macrocosm, as the medieval alchemists were fond of saying. Once again, this is evidence of a pure democracy. Nobody's elect nobody's to office, and then everyone wonders, quote, what went wrong? All of this reflects the power of horizontal understanding. Again, what you see is what you get. Let me dwell just a moment on this business of the emptiness of American life, because I think it really goes to the heart of the matter. I first became aware of the reality of this phenomenon in the late 70s. I was living in San Francisco at the time. Some art gallery mounted a collection of photographs of anonymous European faces from the 20s and the 30s. And what struck me as I went through that exhibition was the depth and the complexity of those faces and how different they were from American faces, which tend to be rather bland. I began to notice this more and more as the years went on. Then last month, as it turns out, I happened to be in Barcelona for a few weeks, and the Museum of Modern European Art hosted an exhibition of 20th century Catalan sculpture, most of it consisting of busts of ordinary people. And again, one sees a real presence in these faces, a real self-awareness. There's no mistaking it. Finally, the very next day after that, I went to MACBA, the Museum of Contemporary Art, and discovered that there was a collection of portraits on display by the English photographer Craigie Horsfield of people in Barcelona in 1996, for which Horsfield was nominated for the Turner Prize. Once again, the sense of an inner life was so dramatically present in the eyes and expressions of these folks, and someone, perhaps the curator of the exhibition, wrote of Horsfield's work, "His individual portraits remind us of the configuration of a civil society in which dissent remains as alive as ever." I immediately flashed on the film Compliance. I don't know if you folks have seen this. It came out last year, but run, don't walk to your nearest Blockbuster or whatever and rent the DVD or buy it. It's a fictional reconstruction of an event that took place more than 70 times in more than 30 states, in which someone impersonated a police officer over the phone and then got his fellow Americans to unquestioningly do whatever he asked, no matter how outrageous or degrading. You really have to see this film. It's quite unusual. This is a sad x-ray of the American psyche, it seems to me, revealing the complete absence of an inner voice. At the end of the movie, the woman who caused the most damage as a result of her blind obedience is interviewed on television, and all she wants to talk about is the weather in New Orleans. What else would one expect in a nation in which the cultural icons are not Garcia Lorca or Picasso, but Tony Robbins and Donald Trump? A nation that, to quote Barbara Ehrenreich, is vapidly bright-sided, thinks Oprah is a sage, and has literally no understanding of the tragic dimensions of life. A nation whose people wear smiley buttons and constantly tell each other to have a nice day. No vertical analysis is required here. The reality of our situation is staring us in the face. Thomas Young, a dying Iraq war veteran, put it this way in a letter he wrote to Bush and Cheney: "Your positions of authority, your millions of dollars of personal wealth, your public relations consultants, your privilege and power cannot mask the hollowness of your character." The problem with the philosophy of more is that more, as already noted, doesn't have any intrinsic meaning. After all, once you have it, then you want more. That's the American dream. But the awareness of this dynamic, assuming we ever get to the point of awareness, puts us in a particular bind, at least as far as serious social change is concerned. We are finally talking about a kind of conversion experience. And beyond the individual level, which is itself no small achievement, that can only happen when history presents us with a no-win situation. The bald fact is that we cannot maintain the American dream, now foolishly being pursued by the Chinese, because we are running out of resources, oil in particular. The American dream cannot survive without energy, and lots of it. Our conversion to a different mental outlook will thus come in the form of a crunch, in which the subdued lights and the quiet shadows, I mean this in Tanizaki sense, that is, a kind of austerity or Zen restraint, we'll get praised because we can no longer afford to have the bright lights burning 24/7. The Russian-American sociologist Peterim Sorokin called this the shift from a sensate culture to an ideational one. And it is this shift that we are not now caught up in. If history is any guide, it won't be a whole lot of fun. Because when you've been doing something for a long time, it becomes very hard to shift gears. I suspect it's a little like detoxing from heroin. But there could be a few benefits as well, so let me conclude by suggesting what they might be. First, under the American dream, people waste their lives by never being present in them. To quote George Carlin once again, they call it the American dream because you've got to be asleep to believe it. Since the goal is more, real life is always seen as being on the horizon, always about to start at some future point. It's an absurd way to live when you think about it. One reason I moved to Mexico several years ago is that despite the heavy Americanization of Mexican society, there still remains the vestige, the ambiance of a traditional culture, one not constantly trying to get somewhere. Americans tend to laugh at this mañana culture, but I doubt they're going to have the last laugh. The truth is that they don't know what they're missing, and it should come as no surprise that the U.S. consistently ranks below Mexico in world happiness polls. Most days for me begin by getting up, making myself a cup of tea, and sitting on the couch and staring into space for an hour, thinking about absolutely nothing at all. I can't really describe the pleasure of this wu wei, as it is called in Chinese philosophy, this non-doing, except to say that I wish it for all of us. The freedom from an agenda may be one of the greatest freedoms around. Secondly, as the consumer society and the American dream continue to disintegrate, many will experience a severe crisis of meaning, inasmuch as prior to the crunch, meaning was to be found in the latest technological gadget or piece of software or brand of lip gloss or whatever. I see lots of nervous breakdowns on the horizon. But as one droll observer once put it, the trick is to convert a nervous breakdown into a nervous breakthrough. After all, 20th century life offered human beings in the West, at least, a set number of master narratives, communism, fascism, and consumerism primarily, so that they might be able to avoid the most terrifying question of all, who am I? As the I Ching tells us, crisis means danger plus opportunity. Wouldn't it be great to discover that one was more than one's career, for example, or one's car? That opportunity is going to present itself sooner or later. For many, it already has. Third, along with all this, there might be a shift in the definition of happiness. Now, there's an interesting thought. The damage that the American way of life has done to community, friendship, sexual relations, daily social interaction, the family, the workplace, and the nature of work itself is colossal. This loss has been documented in volume after volume of studies of contemporary American society, most famously, I suppose, in Robert Putnam's book of 2000, Bowling Alone, although I have to say that in a qualitative sense, Neil Postman anticipated Professor Putnam's statistical findings by quite a few years. In any case, we now have many such studies at our disposal, including novels such as Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, a depressing book that shows that we have no real freedom at all. There are also a number of stunning films on the costs of this way of life, such as Margin Call with Jeremy Irons, or Up in the Air with George Clooney, or Compliance, which I already referred to. A good deal of modern American culture, writes Thomas Lewis in his book, A General Theory of Love, is an extended experiment in the effects of depriving people of what they crave most. Let me repeat that. A good deal of modern American culture is an extended experiment in the effects of depriving people of what they crave most. That the systematic destruction of all these things, community, friendship, and so on, might come to an end is, in my view, a cause for celebration. In fact, for some Americans, at least, it might mean the return of what it means to be human. Typically, neighbors in the United States have no relationship with each other. They don't even know each other's names. Children barely see their parents, who throw money at them, if they have money to throw, in lieu of loving them or even talking to them. None of this, I wish to point out, requires vertical analysis. These things speak for themselves, as, for example, Franzen's novel makes abundantly clear. They say as much about the vapidity of American life as the vacant look in the president's eyes or the empty rhetoric of his speeches. You get my point. In any case, these are some of the benefits that we might receive if and when the current way of life can no longer be maintained. Taken as a whole, they add up to the remark made 150 years ago by the Victorian art critic and social reformer John Ruskin, whom Mahatma Gandhi called the single greatest influence on his way of thinking. There is no wealth but life. Gandhi's version of this was, I have no message. My life is my message. Ruskin would have agreed with both Wittgenstein and Tanizaki, I suspect, that it's the shadows that have the most to teach us. Thank you.
It's a 57 Chevy that veers to the left and lurches to the right. America is a pawn shop window with decals of Old Glory made by children in China. America is a dog playing poker, saying war is a last resort, and wagging his tail. America is a compassionate conservative, and a gay Republican, and a vegetarian vampire. Hung on the wall of an Indian casino.
sessions with one guy in the corner who will not shut up. God bless the firefighter. God bless the video clerk. And God bless America. It just might work. Just might work. In Missouri, doing Louis Armstrong. America is a scholarly discussion of the socioeconomic implications of Janet Jackson's boob.
Roy Zimmerman on the oddities of life in these United States. This is a more upbeat, optimistic view of things than Morris Berman's. America, it just might work, sings Zimmerman. I don't think so, says Berman. For Berman, the collapse has already begun. With luck, the system will go before it destroys the entire ecosystem. But let's not count on luck. We haven't had much so far. Well, since Berman has referred a few times to T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Men, why don't we end by reading just a few lines from it? Eliot wrote, "We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men. Leaning together, headpieces filled with straw. Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom remember us, if at all, not as lost violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper." And I guess this is the way our show ends, not with a bang, but with T.S. Eliot. Thank you for listening. And thanks again to Robin Upton for Berman's speech. Check out Robin's broadcasts at unwelcomeguests.net. And check out our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust advising, illegitimi non carborundum, question authority, support your alternative radio station, and please come back again next week. Ciao.